Poetry on the Radio. Poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the second of two instalments in conversation with Canberra-based poet Carmel Summers. Plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from the region. For ArtSound FM, I'm Peter Searles. Carmel Summers' poetry has been shortlisted in several poetry prizes, including the Australian Catholic University Prize in 2023. She has an MA in creative writing from Macquarie University and is writing a poetic biography of Eliza Cook as part of her PhD at the University of Canberra. Her collection, Lost in the Pleiades, inspired by the Pleiades, or Seven Sisters constellation, launched last Monday at Smith's Alternative. Carmel Summers' work ranges through genres and forms, taking in Japanese forms and formal and unstructured poetry and ways of revealing history through poetry. Last week, we spoke with Carmel Summers about her work to date, particularly Lost in the Pleiades. We ended by hearing about her current project, a poetical biography of Eliza Cook, the wife of explorer Captain James Cook. We hear more about that project this week.
I chose her because she's been forgotten by history, partly through her own choosing, because she destroyed all her correspondence before she died. So there is little record of her life. And I thought, oh, that sets me a challenge. One, why did she burn all those letters? And then why can't we find out more about her? So I set myself the task of finding out more about her, and I'm halfway through that task now.
And so that task leads you to a PhD,
That
right?
task led me to a PhD, yeah. Which I'm doing on poetic biography, on finding out whether the act of poetry subverts truth in a biography.
That's a huge question.
Yes, and I think it's an important question because we're so used to prose biographies, but poetry has so much more to offer in terms of the questions that it leaves open for the reader. And I think that's important, particularly when the details of a person's life are not known, but we can surmise, we can make some certain informed assumptions. There's also that dreaming room where we've got to leave the reader open to draw their own conclusions. And I think poetry is ideally situated for that task.
I think something else that makes poetry ideal for that kind of a task, and this was part of my own work with my own project, is the idea that it doesn't have to be linear. Like prose, quite often, I mean, you can make prose nonlinear if you're arranging it in certain ways, but I think poetry is inherently nonlinear. And I think that really comes through in your book, and it's just to go back to it for a minute, where you're taking sort of the present day world and you're taking mythology and you're taking religious belief, and a poem brings that all together into a single moment. It doesn't matter where in time we are.
It doesn't matter where we are in time. It's true. And I think, as you, again, it comes back to those question marks that you can explore through poetry. And one of the poems I wrote, which was shortlisted in the ACU Poetry Prize this year, 2023, was based on a waistcoat that Elizabeth Cook was embroidering for her husband. Now, it was made out of tapa cloth, which was special cloth from Tahiti that he'd brought back from his second voyage. When I was speaking to the librarians at the State Library, they said they'd had a delegation from Tahiti the previous week, had looked at this particular waistcoat and said, this is special cloth. This is reserved for infants, for wrapping infants. It's very fine tapa. So perhaps it was given to Cook for one of his children, because when he left, she was pregnant again on his final voyage. Of course, he never returned because he met his end in Hawaii. This is called The Unfinished Waistcoat. I have pondered what to do with this tapa, a gift from Prince Otu, a cloth, he said, reserved for chiefs or their princelings, layers of mulberry bark pounded into cloth, creamy, thick, soft, yet unyielding, like my Mr. Cook. He may have thought I would use it to swaddle our newborn, but I thought, a cloth so different from linen or silk would raise a stir when he is presented to the king, as surely as he will be when he returns. I cut a pattern measured from his old naval waistcoat, Trace heat onto tapa cloth, mount it on fine linen, stretch it on a frame, and I am ready. This garment, a statement in tapa. No folderol of sprigs to spot the fronts, like the waistcoat I'd made after his first voyage, that he said made him feel like a dandy, though it suited him well enough when we dined with Boswell. I lay out 16 silks, 3 shades each of blue, green, red, yellow, pink, and 1 of brown, silver thread and spangles. I have chosen elegance, not flamboyance, a design from the ladies' magazine. I prick the outline into the pattern, lay it carefully on the fabric, sprinkle powder to transfer the design, trace with faint pencil strokes, try to align the design left and right. Too late, I notice some irregularities, so slight, though Mr. Cook will notice. I thread mid-green into the tambour, work the wavery margins, follow with silver thread along the scrolls, add flowers and leaves in graduated colours, long and short stitch, chain stitch. I finish with spangles of beaten silver. Each afternoon, week after week, while I stitch, Mrs. Honeychurch marks my progress, reads aloud the shipping news, reminds me that the lack of news concerning my husband's bird portends well. Tomorrow I can start to stitch it all together. Of course, she never did.
It's interesting how, now that I know about your background in textile, back to textile mm-hmm. in a way.
Yes. Yes, I spent an afternoon in the State Library with the librarian. I had an appointment to view this from top and bottom and have a look at it, see how it was made, and you could see in which order the stitching was done.
Were you
allowed
to
touch it? From the back of the design.
Did they let you?
With gloves.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that's exciting.
It was very exciting.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's really amazing to me how something, an object, can inform a poem.
Yes,
can
absolutely.
Ignite the imagination and lead you to.
Yes, because it's not just the story of the poem, of the waistcoat and the way it was made, but also what was happening in her life at that moment. She's waiting and waiting and waiting and filling the hours, not knowing.
You mentioned that there's not a lot of information about Elizabeth Cook. So where have you ended up finding things, and are there any significant gaps that you're still wrestling with and trying to fill?
Yes, there are. Well, I started off with ancestry, births, deaths, marriages, and found out a lot about the timings of the births and deaths of all her children, of her, she herself, her marriage, her parents' marriages, and so on. So that was a starting point. I also read, of course, through all the Cook biographies and his journals. So there's a little smatterings of information, not very much at all. Then I spent a lot of time National Library, State Library, New South Wales, the British Library, Cambridgeshire Archives, up in Whitby at various museums. And I've talked to curators, and you'll find little snippets in all these places. So National Library, for instance, is a whole file of correspondence between various people who lived in the street, her old neighbours, and a lady who was her cousin who moved to America, Frances McAllister, who was Frances Wardle, who lived with her for a little while when the children were small and Cook was away. So you find a lot of background information that way. And then I found there were, as a book produced on letters by her cousin's family, cousins that she'd lived with, and some of these cousins had been her companions, and you know, they have all these references. Just by that might be just one reference, one sentence in a letter that refers to Elizabeth Cook, their cousin, and how they'd gone on a shopping trip with her to Cheltenham, and she'd kept them there all day. And they were very relieved when their caretaker duties were over.
How many children did she have?
She had 6 children and they all died.
Oh, yes. My goodness.
The poem that you read bears out what I'm gathering from your description of your research, is that your poem has a sense of information and perspectives being sort of discovered as you go, And that's retained in the poem, as it is in, say, the best journalism. And you clearly have a very strong journalistic sort of sense as well.
Well, I guess having to write for different audiences all my life has been, that hones that sense of trying to keep the interest alive in what you're writing, rather than just get dragged down to the floor by facts. Sometimes you can't avoid that, but but you find little snippets of information. I spent weeks actually just going through the old British newspaper archives when I was in England. And you can do searches. A lot of them are digitised, so you can do searches on a name and you'll find out any reference to, say, Cook. There are millions of them, and I looked at every one. And then I found one in a newspaper about 20 years after she died. It was a reference to Mrs. Cook, wife of the navigator. And, of course, well, my antenna came up. And it was a case of a journeyman baker who'd been taken to court and fined for trading out of hours. Now, in the time of King George, so in the mid-18th century, a law came through, the first protection for journeymen bakers, in that they weren't allowed to trade after 12:30 on a Sunday to give them time with their family. It was the only time of the week they were allowed home, basically. And this person argued in court that a certain baker had left a pie outside their shop at 12:30, that had been ordered for Mrs. Cook, wife of the navigator, and she'd failed to collect it and in time, and a dog had come along and eaten it. So Mrs. Cook took the baker to court and sued him for non-delivery of her pie that she was obviously going to have for dinner that night, which tells us a little bit about her.
It does. I think.
And what was interesting is she lost the court case. So, but it was just interesting. You find these snippets in these really strange little bits of information that you don't expect.
And thinking about, you know, an unfinished piece of clothing too, then your job is to take these snippets and then stitch them together.
Absolutely, yeah. Stitch them together. The whole thing is a bit like, I keep thinking of it as either a crazy quilt, or sometimes I think of it as a jigsaw with all these pieces, and I think there's got to be order in it. And I think of these old crime series that you see where they have their storyboard up on the wall with all the bits and pieces and all the lines to missing information. And I feel as if I'm doing that at the moment, you know, all the time trying to drag the pieces together.
I'm thinking about what you just said about order, and you're trying to use all the different forms that you know in the book.
I am trying to. So I'm trying to, as part of the book, because I wanted to challenge myself technically as well as not only just for the research, but in terms of as a poet, to try and grow as a poet. I'm trying to address every form of poetry that I know as part of this book. So there are sonnets, there are villanelles, there are tanka, there are haibun, there are...
Have you got a pantoum?
I have done a pantoum already. There's a lot of free verse of necessity. There are ditties, there's a sailor's ditty in there. I've just gone to town a little bit. I mean, but of course I want to enjoy the process as well.
How many pages or poems do you have?
Look, it'll be about 200 pages by the time I finish.
That's a big book. Poetry. That's really exciting.
Yes, well, I'm hoping so. And there's a few visual, there's a visual poem in there that's quite visual, I'll say. But still, I wanted it to be a visual poem, but also I wanted it to be readable. So people might look at it and see, oh, there's just words thrown onto this black background with tears, strips through the paper. But actually it does read as a poem.
Yeah.
As you pick up the words.
Yeah.
What motivated you to write about Elizabeth Cook? Are there existing biographies or?
No, there are two existing biographies. Well, there are two fictional biographies. I didn't know about those at the time when I chose her. One of them's only recently come out from Sweden, in translation from Sweden. And one of them was by Morell Day, which was quite well researched, but she says it's the real and imagined life of the navigator. But So that would come the closest to a real biography. The other one is very imagined, very fictionalized, and totally inaccurate from what I can see from the research. Mm. Some years ago, Germaine Greer put out a book called Mrs. Shakespeare. And that got me thinking, that must be 10 more years ago. I don't know, quite a long time ago. And I was sort of interested in that. And I thought, oh, fancy writing about the wife. And I thought, and then I, not too long, and that just had my brain little questions going there. And then a few years later, I was listening to some radio broadcast, and I don't even know, and it just caught my eye that said, oh, we don't know anything about Mrs. Elizabeth Cook because she burnt all their correspondence before she died. And that just set all, you know, got my radar going, and I thought, oh, I want to find out why. And then I thought, well, I want to do this, but I didn't know whether I'd, at that stage, I was going to write a traditional biography. But
what have you found, or what do you imagine her to have been?
Well, I think she was, you know, you see this woman who has lost all six children and then went on to live till she was 93. But she lived a full and fruitful life. I don't think she was a little fading violet that people took her for. In Cook's life, they were married for 17 years, but of that time they spent just over 4 years together in the same house because he was off to sea all the time, right from the early days of their marriage. So I think she was a fairly tough woman, I really, is coming across to me from what I can see. She knew her rights and insisted on her rights. Some of the letters, that there are four letters existing in her hand, and I've read them all. And she actually demanded royalties of the book proceeds from Cook's The Final Voyage. No, she made no two bones about it. So and so she wasn't shy in coming forward. Let's put it that way.
It's often said that, you know, behind every great man there's a wife or woman, but you inversely, despite every great man, there's a woman who perhaps has her own agency and individuality.
I think that's closer to the point, because I think when they were together, I get the impression that he made up his mind to go about his business, and he was very non-focused on the family or the wife, because when he was home, he just got straight into work. Mm-hmm. He built a man shed in the backyard, because I've looked at the tax records for that part of the of Mile End Old Town, and not long after they bought the house, when he came back from their first voyage, first thing that happened on the rates notice is a shed in the backyard as well. So
He liked his space
and I think nothing was going to stand, a house full of children wasn't going to stop him doing his work, and he was off to the Admiralty most days, so I think they didn't see much of each other.
Where was she from?
She was a Londoner.
Okay.
He was from Yorkshire, she was a Londoner. And I think they met through when he used to travel down on the coal ships from Whitby to London. There was a bit of a Quaker connection. He worked for a Quaker, John Walker. And there was a family, the Quakers were fairly close in a part of Wapping. And one of the Quaker connections was to the Bell Inn, or Bell Ale House. And that was owned by her mother and stepfather. Mm-hmm. And it's believed that Cook used to stay there when he was travelling to and from Whitby. And that's when he met her.
Oh, okay.
So as a child, she would have been a child.
Do you think you have an answer by now as to why she destroyed their correspondence without wanting to give away anything?
I have two theories. One of them is that she considered it too personal and private, that she didn't want the world knowing about it. But my own personal theory is that she took a lot of steps to keep the name of Cook up there. After his death, she went to great lengths, and I think that she believed that any weakness shown in those correspondence, anything that might sully his name, she wanted to stop that going out into the public.
Wow.
And there are some question marks about the oldest son, whether or not he had an illegitimate child, which she wanted to cover up, would have wanted to cover up.
Wow.
So, that's my theory anyway.
Yeah.
So
Carmel Summers has contributed poems to a weekly series of Poetry on the Radio segments that has been running for a couple of years. In the series, which airs during Art Sounds Arts Cafe on Thursdays between 1:15 and 1:30 p.m, poets read one of their poems, talk about it, and then read it again. Let's listen to one of those segments.
Starry Messenger. Indeed, with the glass you will detect below stars of the sixth magnitude such a crowd of others that escape natural light that it is hardly believable. Galileo Galilei. Orion's constellation overwhelms me, so many points of light and no time. The heavens, my telescope, the lens so narrow, incessant interruptions as clouds lower and linger. My son and daughters in their cot. In our bed, Maria Gamba sleeps, a pastime I can ill afford. I draw my breath from the night sky, the stretch and fall of stars. My naked eye, pupil dark adapted, its aperture always a limit. Sometimes I can see and sometimes not. I count the stars of the bull called Pleiades. It deceives me. 6 or 9 flicker in and out of my vision. Between clouds, waiting, always waiting, telescope ready. My hands tremble and I see nothing but a blur, lose my place in the sky. This moment when I seize my pen, draw the first dots on my map, 6 black points. I long for dark parchment and golden ink instead. I draw the large 6, mark them again with double outlines, my anchor in the skies. Each day I grind and polish my glass, lens convex, eyepiece concave, each to complement the other, ready for the night rise. The cocks are quiet, noise from the tavern, croaks like frog call in the swaddle of Brenta's shores. I wait for the Pleiades to rise. My eyes, I blink and blink to clear them, narrow my lids, count the lesser stars, map their winding passage past the larger sisters, add the 36 of which I'm sure, carefully preserve their mutual distances and sizes. Knowing, not knowing, fearful to show my findings to the world, the vast expanse of otherness, outside our world, but belonging in ways I cannot know. The key to knowledge is this glass I grind and polish, mount in its holder, frame the lens from external light. Even as I draw these distant stars, I know there is more, much more. How can we on earth discover all there is? The Pleiades, the sky, the moon, the sun, and how they form a whole. This is a dramatic monologue based on Galileo Galilei's treatise, which was called Sidereus Nuncius, which translates to Starry Messenger. It was written in 1610, and it was groundbreaking as the first publication that described the heavens viewed through a telescope. In his work, he mapped 36 stars of the Pleiades and the craters of the moon. Starry Messenger. Orion's constellation overwhelms me, so many points of light and no time. The heavens, my telescope, the lens so narrow, incessant interruptions as clouds lower and linger. My son and daughters in their cot. In our bed, Maria Gamba sleeps, a pastime I can ill afford. I draw my breath from the night sky, the stretch and fall of stars. My naked eye, pupil dark adapted, its aperture always the limit. Sometimes I can see and sometimes not. I count the stars of the bull called Pleiades. It deceives me. 6 or 9 flicker in and out of my vision. Between clouds, waiting, always waiting, telescope ready. My hands tremble and I see nothing but a blur, lose my place in the sky. This moment when I seize my pen, draw the first dots on my map, 6 black points. I long for dark parchment and golden ink instead. I draw the large 6, mark them again with double outlines, my anchor in the skies. Each day I grind and polish my glass, lens convex, eyepiece concave, each to complement the other, ready for night rise. The cocks are quiet, noise from the tavern, croaks like frog call in the swaddle of Brenta's shores. I wait for the Pleiades to rise. My eyes, I blink and blink to clear them, narrow my lids, count the lesser stars, map their winding passage past their larger sisters, add the 36 of which I'm sure carefully preserve their mutual distances and sizes. Knowing, not knowing, fearful to show my findings to the world, the vast expanse of otherness, outside our world, but belonging in ways I cannot know. The key to knowledge is this glass I grind and polish, mount in its holder, frame the lens from external light. Even as I draw these distant stars, I know there is more, much more. How can we on earth discover all there is? The Pleiades, the sky, the moon, the sun, and how they form a whole.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, as on last week's episode, we've spoken with Canberra-based poet Carmel Summers. Her latest publication is her collection, Lost in the Pleiades. Next week, our guest will be Theodore L. For ArtSound FM, I'm Peter Searles.
The Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. Congratulations to Judith Nangala Crispin, whose poem of the dead woman was shortlisted for the 2024 Peter Porter Prize. The winner, announced late in January, was New South Wales poet Dan Hogan for Workarounds. Also on the shortlist was Immigration Triction by Western Australia poet Natalie Damjanovich Napoleon, who will join us in coming months on Poetry on the Radio. The shortlisted poems appear on the Australian Book Review website. The weekly Monday poetry readings at Smith's Alternative in Civic have resumed. On Monday, February 29, that poetry thing is a big open mic. On March 4, Jeff's Poetry at Smith's presents Jennifer Compton and Martin Dolan. Jennifer Compton lives in Melbourne. Recent work in Canberra published her 11th book of poetry, The Moment Taken, in 2021. She won the Melbourne Poets Union Open Mic Prize in 2017 and was highly commended for the Melbourne Spoken Word Prize in 2017 and 2018. She has also had many stage and radio plays produced, including The Big Picture, published by Currency Press, which premiered at the Griffin Theatre in Sydney. Canberra poet Martin Dolan has been writing and publishing for 25 years. He has published 4 collections of poetry, most recently On the Record, from Recent Work Press, 2023. He has been one of the organisers of that poetry thing since 2017. Martin is also chair of Australian Poetry, the national body for Australian poetry, and will appear on a forthcoming instalment of Poetry on the Radio. On March 11, that poetry thing presents Coralie Dimitriadis and Kate Lyons. On March 18, Recent Work Reading presents Jen Webb. And on March 26, that poetry thing presents Angie Contini and Maya Brown. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly in the studios of ArtSound FM in Canberra on unceded traditional land. Hosts Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles create the program with producer Peter Monaghan. Poetry on the Radio is heard each Sunday at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is from William O. Bill Smith's 2008 jazz opera Space in the Heart. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope performed by the Atrium Musica de Madrid.
Hi, it's Rich Pascal here, lifelong bluegrass fanatic, and I'd love to share my joy with bluegrass with you on Leaves of Bluegrass, Saturday mornings 10 o'clock, Monday afternoons at 4. Come and listen to this marvelous music.
From plain chant to polyphony, from troubadour songs to trio sonatas, 600 years of music from Hildegard to Bach. The early music experience with me, Mark Shepherd, Sunday evenings at 7 here on ArtSound FM.